Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show!
Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by San Pellegrino Sparkling Natural Mineral Water. For more than 120 years, San Pellegrino has been inspiring people to savor life and tasteful moments around the table. As chefs and restaurants have evolved worldwide, San Pellegrino has always been there to complement the food they serve, the moments they create, and to support them in both good and challenging times. Learn more at sanpellegrino.com. The following episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs is brought to you in part by Bento Box and Clover. From websites and marketing tools to point of sale, payments, and ordering, Bento Box and Clover together offer all the unified technology you need for restaurant success. Learn more and book a demo today at getbento.com/better.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
I think there's a lot of things that I don't know about meat in terms of a chef in the culinary world. There's a lot of things that I've never had, I've never tried, and probably never will, unfortunately, and I don't know how to cook those things. But I think the real key and the real trick is flavor and texture. Like, that's simply it. It doesn't matter if you're cooking meat or if you're cooking vegan. If it tastes good and there's a nice texture on there, you've got it.
That is the voice of Shanari Freeman of the plant-based soul food restaurant Cadence in New York City, and an upcoming residency as part of the Shifting the Lens series at J Vineyards Winery in Healdsburg, California. Shanari is our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Freedman. I hope everyone out there is doing well. Our feature guest today is Shanari Freeman of Cadence Restaurant in New York City and a chef who will be participating in the Shifting the Lens residency series at J Vineyards Winery in Healdsburg, California, starting in about a week. More on Shanari and all of that in just a moment. I do want to share, though, before I get to this week's interview, an experience I had last week. I'm going to call it an experience. I was walking around our new neighborhood in downtown Brooklyn. As I've mentioned on the show previously, Caitlin, my wife, and I recently moved back to New York City from the suburbs. And we were taking a walk with our dog on Saturday morning, and I walked past this absolutely beautiful little restaurant in Brooklyn Heights, I guess, is technically the neighborhood. And the restaurant is called Clover Hill. It's small. It's very prettily designed. And I didn't know anything about this restaurant. It's in the middle of a residential block. Something about it kind of spoke to me. The menu looked very appealing. I went home and I looked it up online, and the chef, Charlie Mitchell, has quite the resume. Charlie worked at 11 Madison Park, Bettany, 1 White Street, and other restaurants. I mentioned it to some friends of mine who are fellow food writers and photographers and other people in the industry. One or two of them had vaguely heard of it, but not too much. And I went to dinner there. It is primarily a tasting menu restaurant, but I went and had dinner at the bar, Caitlin and I, last week. They do offer a la carte dining at the bar. There's just a couple of seats there. Kate's usually not able to do a tasting menu. It's just more food than she usually wants. But I was really knocked out by everything about this restaurant. I was knocked out by the lighting. I was knocked out by the vibe. I was knocked out by the music mix. I was very charmed by the gracious hospitality. Charlie's food, the food that he and his team are kicking out, is just wonderful. The bread and butter were so good that we actually had two orders of it. And I got to talking to Charlie and to the owner, Clay, at the end of my meal. And I found out, sure enough, these guys have been without a PR firm for a little while. They've just now started with a PR firm again. And it really brought home to me something I've talked about on the show and elsewhere over the years, which is that restaurants who either are between PR agencies or who can't afford a PR agency or who don't want a PR agency, they are so disadvantaged. They really are. I don't want to be critical of the journalistic community that are unable to kind of sleuth out these restaurants. But periodically over the years, I've been made aware through cases like this that if you don't have a PR firm, it is very easy to fly under the radar in a way that's just not good for business. I mean, I feel like this place should be certainly for people in Brooklyn right up there on places they want to know about. So I want to tell my New York listeners to check out Clover Hill. As many of you may know, the Michelin Guide recently released a list of new entrants to the upcoming Michelin list for New York. They did not reveal at what level each of those new entrants will appear, but Clover Hill was on that list. So they've caught the attention of the Michelin Guide, I'm happy to say. I'm also happy to say that in my reading last weekend, I found out that they had gotten a wonderful 5-star review from Time Out New York. So kudos to Time Out New York. But I did want to say I recommend this restaurant very highly. And I also want to say if you have a restaurant out there that you don't have PR for, shoot me a DM on Instagram. The handle for the show is at Chef Podcast. My personal handle is at Toqueland Andrew, Toqueland Andrew. I have limited time and resources. I can't promise I will get to your restaurant. I do live in New York City. So if your restaurant is in the New York area, there's a better chance I'll get there. If it's in a major market that I get to with some regularity, like Chicago or Los Angeles, where I'm headed in a few weeks, there's also a chance I will get there in my travels. But, I would like to support places that don't have PR. As I say, Clover Hill is now working with a PR firm again, and I hope that will help them become as known as I feel like they ought to be. There's a real story there and really good food. In any event, I wanted to share all of that with you. I also want to let all of you know that I am among the people who will be participating in the LA Chef Conference. That is an event that I've been a part of in the past. This is their first time back at it since COVID. The event is produced by my friend Brad Metzger, who has Brad Metzger Restaurant Solutions, which is a hospitality recruitment company. It's a wonderful event. It takes place this year on October 17th. I will link to where you can get tickets on the episode page for this show. I will be speaking with someone I admire quite a bit, Chef Mary Sue Milliken. We're going to be doing a conversation about the restaurant reset. Remember the restaurant reset that we were all talking about in the early days of COVID, how the industry was going to reinvent itself and deal with all of its dysfunction? And that doesn't seem to have happened. Some people are trying to make some meaningful changes in their restaurants and their operations, but as a widespread thing, it doesn't seem to have quite taken hold. Mary Sue and I are going to discuss that. We're going to be taking questions. She's someone who's been in the industry for decades and has an amazing perspective and obviously is still a very successful chef operator. So I will look forward to that. If you are in the Los Angeles area or will be visiting in mid-October, I hope you'll come. Again, that is Monday the 17th. And again, I will link to where you can learn more and where you can get your tickets on the episode page for this show at Andrew Talks to Chefs and also at Apple Podcasts and all other platforms where links are functional. Running a restaurant means keeping up with the times. And now more than ever, the times keep changing. Luckily, technology has the power to make keeping up a whole lot easier. Bento Box and Clover are now working together to provide restaurants with the technology they need for even more success. From Bento Box's world-class website design and marketing tools to Clover's state-of-the-art solutions for managing point-of-sale transactions and payments, every detail that goes into a great hospitality experience is supported and streamlined. So whether you own or operate a restaurant or group of restaurants, you're free to focus more time on human interactions, which of course is what restaurants are all about. I encourage you to learn more and book a demo today at getbento.com/better. And on this episode, we're introducing the first in a limited series of short special report interviews on the subjects of restaurants and technology. These are brought to you by Bento Box and Clover. And on this episode, we're examining how to make your restaurant website work best for you. That's something that probably I would venture to say a majority of our listeners will be interested in. And here to discuss the subject is Bento Box's Director of Design Operations, Jacqueline Andre, who goes by Jack. She spells that J-A-Q. She does go by Jack. That's how I address her in our short interview. And with that, here's our conversation. Jack, thank you very much for joining us. We are talking today about restaurant websites, and I mean, pretty much any restaurant that's doing a certain amount of business or hoping to do a certain amount of business today has a website. To the untrained eye, to the unprofessional eye, a lot of them maybe are very similar, but what for you are some of the key things that a lot of people overlook maybe when they're building or designing a website?
This is a great question. It's a little bit tough because it's different for everybody, but some big ones that I see, and this might sound strange coming from somebody that is a design expert, but I'd say that being so focused on the design that the site's usability and functionality actually suffers from it. Usually this can manifest in a number of different ways, but one big one that we oftentimes see is using really big assets. So things like graphics or animations, really super high-res photography, things that take a lot longer to load can cause lag time for visitors to the site and then ultimately kind of, you know, sully the user experience.
So this is kind of like the great TV commercial that's really clever or funny, but when it's all over, you can't remember what the sponsor was or what it was for.
Yeah, exactly. Like sometimes the messaging gets lost in the design and it can be an incredible design. But if you don't know, you know, what to do once you get there, then, you know, ultimately the purpose is lost. We really encourage making sure that things that are really important to your business that drive revenue are easily accessed. And that should be, you know, supported by the design, not buried by it. Hours and locations, how to find your place, menus. People love looking at menus. If you are pushing online ordering, make sure that you can see that button somewhere on the site. What we encourage people to do is just think about the content first. And this is actually how we operate at Bento Box. You get your content out first, and then the design comes. And the design should really enhance that experience that the user is having with the website, not necessarily bury it.
Is there any information people tend to overlook sometimes? I know a lot of restaurants, especially those run by younger proprietors, don't even necessarily have a phone anymore. But I'm very surprised sometimes when like an address or a phone number isn't easily findable, you know, even on a homepage. Is that outdated thinking on my part, or is that something that people tend to accidentally bury on their sites?
I think it's more of an accident, and it's like an assumption that they're going to find that the user is finding that information on a different website. You know, they're like, oh, well, they probably got here via Google Maps or something like that. You're not wrong. What we like to say too is your website should be the source of truth. You shouldn't have to send somebody somewhere else to find out all the information about you.
Obviously, websites are promoting restaurants, at least for the purposes of this conversation. Restaurants are, I think of them almost like living, breathing entities unto themselves. They have personalities. They have an energy. They have a design component. They have a vibe. Obviously, when you go to a website, you're not physically visiting the restaurant, although you're maybe trying to get a sense of it. You're maybe to some degree shopping for where you want to have dinner or have a certain occasion. What are some of the ways, without overwhelming people like we were just talking about, is that you can get a sense of what your restaurant is across in a virtual medium?
I think a lot of that goes into the design. And so really being able to translate the brand's look and feel from the physical space to the digital is really important. And it's, you know, it can be surprisingly easy to do if you're looking at the right things. So this is actually what my team does at Bento Box. Our process is much the same. We look at the physical menus that the restaurant has. We look at their brand colors. We look at the interior designs. You know, sometimes the restaurant will have specific patterns or motifs that we can extrapolate and pull them into the website design. And so those are all really great ways to bridge those two. I will also say great photography is super important. You know, a great photo can be a portal into the restaurant itself. It can make somebody feel like they're already sitting at the table. If you have a great photo of the dish and it's open on like their phone or their tablet.
What about language? High energy language versus more serious language, maybe for a super formal fine dining restaurant. Are those things that you encourage people to think about as they put their site together?
100%. You actually took the words out of my mouth. Language. so yeah, really being thoughtful about the language and the copy that you're using on the site is also super important. You want to make sure that it embodies your brand voice and aligns with the experience that they're going to have at your space.
There's this phrase call to action that comes up a lot. You know, what are you trying to drive the website visitor to do? It seems to me most websites I look at are fairly, I almost want to say passive about closing the deal, you know, about making the reservation or getting the online order. Very often those pull-down menus are given the same sort of visual prominence or weight as, you know, the contact button or the about us button. You know, there's not a lot of kind of razzle dazzle around hitting a certain pop-up or something like that to make that happen. Is that the right approach for people to take? Is that kind of the, you know, the sort of quiet, confident restaurant that's going to leave it to you to get to that stage? Or could restaurants do a little bit more of a push in terms of trying to get people physically to their space?
I think that that's a great question and also a great observation. It's different for everybody. We do encourage when we're onboarding customers to have them think about what their major revenue drivers are so that we can help them figure out how to prominently place that on their website. It is important to have your CTAs or your calls to action visible and, you know, accessible, but at the same time, like with any business, you're not making money one way. So you just want to make sure that you have everything laid out in such a way that anything that could possibly drive revenue to your restaurant is accessible. If you are looking to really get more butts in seats via reservations, that could be your CTA, but you still want it to be a good experience for the visitor that wants to just place an order online. So having all that information upfront and available is key. It's kind of like specials on a menu. So, you know, you have specials, you have a special dish on the menu. You want your server to relay that to the table, but you also want the customer to be able to see the rest of the menu and make the decision on their own.
Got it. So you want people to have an easy time of doing or accessing what is maybe your primary source of revenue. Let's assume that is a reservation and you're coming in and spending money, but you don't want to do it to the extent that they become unaware or gloss right over maybe your online store where there's gift certificates and t-shirts and a signed exactly. copy of your cookbook and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yep.
What about updating websites? I mean, obviously, if you have a menu that changes every day, you probably want to have somebody responsible for putting the menu online at some point, you know, by lunchtime or so for dinner service. But what about just more generally, you know, refreshing the look of your website periodically, maybe changing the color scheme, or maybe, you know, rewording some of the language so that whatever cultural references you're making are current, all that kind of thing. A lot of websites seem a little stagnant or maybe kind of locked in the moment of time from when the restaurant first opened. Do you encourage people to periodically update their site just for the sake of making it not just more current, but also maybe a little fresh for people who use it a lot, you know, for regulars.
Yeah, we definitely do. I think the industry standard to refresh or redesign your site is something like 2 to 3 years, but it really should be, I think, even if you're just doing small tweaks, like you're saying, like changing the colors up a little bit, it should be annual. You know, at this point, people are just interfacing with digital tools and, you know, websites and all this stuff so often now that having a little glow up every so often can really make a big difference.
Do regulars tend to have that kind of a relationship that I was just kind of implying with restaurant websites? Like, do people who really love a restaurant tend to visit a restaurant the way, say, like, I'm a tennis fan, I go to tennis.com all the time. Do people tend to visit sites of restaurants to see what's, like, if they're like, do foodies go to look at a place like the French Laundry and see what the menu was like, you know, day to day, that kind of thing?
For sure. Yeah. I think, well, just from an anecdotal experience that we're having, we've heard from customers in onboarding that, that have been with us for a while, that they're getting in their redesign. They get feedback from their customers. Their regulars are like, oh my God, I went to the website and I saw that it's new, like such a great job. And it didn't occur to me as somebody who does this for a living that other people are doing this too. And it's also, apart from that, it's just really nice to see inspiration, to see kind of like what's going on and what, from my perspective, like what some of the trends are in some of the web design. Design trends are changing all the time. And I would say especially so with restaurants and food. And so it's really great to kind of website surf.
I'm curious along those lines, you know, a lot of restaurants have things like blogs, you know, on their restaurant website. I assume they largely do that to give people a reason to come back. Assuming that a restaurant does a good job of constantly feeding something like a blog, you know, with content, whether it's, you know, every week or every month, is that something that can actually draw traffic to a restaurant's website?
Yeah, definitely. If they have a robust enough blog, some people already come with followers. Absolutely. We encourage keeping that up. That does drive traffic to the site. I will say more often than not now we're seeing newsletters come into popularity, but other restaurants have other ways of continually bringing traffic in, like maybe only announcing specials via their website or their events as well, you know, keeping a robust event calendar, having that all go through the website too. There are a number of different ways you can keep, I guess, like have repeat visitors coming to the site. The blog isn't just one of them, but it certainly can be.
All right. Well, Jack, thank you very much for joining us. You know, most of our listeners are industry people, so I'm sure they'll find much of this to be of use. And we appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And my thanks again to Jacqueline, Jack, Andre for joining us today. And a reminder to please visit Bento Box and Clover and learn how they can provide you with technology you need for more success. Again, the website is getbento.com/better. So as I say, our guest today is Shanari Freeman. Shanari, as many of you may know, is the chef of Cadence Restaurant in New York City, where she is quickly becoming known and appreciated for her distinctive plant-based soul food. Shanari has a fascinating story, having evolved over the years, and she's still quite young, but she's gone from being a carnivore to being a vegan. She's gone from her hometown of Richmond, Virginia, to New York City, and from an aspiring music professional, obviously, to being a chef. And in addition to Cadence, which is getting a lot of attention, Shanari is participating as the third chef in the inaugural season of the Shifting the Lens series at J. Vineyards Winery in Healdsburg, California. That series is curated by friend of the pod, Prithi Mistry, who was one of the chefs in the series. And the third chef, who's already done her residency, was Jenny Dorsey, who's also been on the show before. Shanari, as I say, is the third and last chef in this inaugural series. whose residency kicks off in about a week, Shinari's does. You can click through to the J Vineyards website for more information and to book tickets. I should note that one of the two venues where Shinari will be offering her food already has a waiting list going. There are seats available in the other venue. So I would say if you are interested, if you live in or close enough to the Healdsburg area that you are considering attending a dinner, or if you'll be visiting that area in the next few weeks, I would encourage you to get right on that. Visit our website, andrewtalkstochefs.com. Go to the episode page for today's show and click through to where you can learn more and get your tickets. As always, our feature interview is presented by Sam Pellegrino. Whether in life or on the plate, every chef has a story to tell. Sam Pellegrino proudly helps them share those stories in their restaurants and right here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. The perfect complement to great food and meaningful interactions, Sam Pellegrino is delighted to be a part of the conversation. Learn more at sanpellegrino.com. And with that, here is my conversation with Chef Shinari Freeman. Here you go. I have been reading a lot about you. You've gotten a lot of attention at Cadence. I said this to you before we started recording. I haven't been to the restaurant yet, but especially now that I'm living in the city again, I will be visiting soon. But why don't you just, because it is a relatively new place, although it doesn't seem to affect the makeup of your customer base, it does exist in the, I guess we would say, the plant-based realm.
Yes.
Before we talk about you and your story and what's going on at J Vineyards, can you just talk a little about Cadence? What is it? How did it come into your life? And what are you doing there?
Cadence is a vegan plant-based soul food restaurant in the East Village. We open March 2021. The restaurant itself is under the Overthrow Hospitality umbrella, which is a group of diverse vegan restaurants here in the city by Robbie DeRossi. I approached the company as a customer, actually. I used to always go and enjoy Lady Bird. I would eat there quite a bit before the pandemic and after the pandemic once restaurants reopened. And during that summer, I believe 2020, I was actually pitched to the company to become a chef. At the time, they didn't have anything available, so I joined the company as a manager for one of the other restaurants. And within a two-week span, the space where Cadence was originally opened up. So once that happened, it was just a matter of conversations, a matter of tastings with the owners, and we started building out Cadence.
What was it like opening during COVID?
It was a learning experience, I would say. It was my first time being an executive chef, my first time opening a restaurant, my first time doing a lot of things. So I was learning throughout the process, but I was also learning a lot about restaurants, a lot about being patient, learning a lot about New York, learning a lot about how to do this and do that with the restaurant. So I would say it was exciting. I was never intimidated. I never had any doubts or anything like that. I was just very excited. So I think that motivation kind of helped me build out the restaurant the way I wanted it to be.
Despite the circumstances of the time.
Yes.
So let's talk about you. You grew up in Richmond, Virginia.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little about, I've never been to Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
I've been to other places in Virginia, usually on the edges of some visit to DC. Can you just talk about what a Richmond childhood was like and specifically what your childhood was like, what the family dynamic was, and, you know, just kind of in general, the circumstances of your childhood?
Growing up in Richmond was really fun. I come from a really big family. I am the youngest granddaughter of 22 cousins.
Oh, my God.
My grandmother on my mom's side had 9 kids, so we have a really big family, and everyone's in Richmond, minus my oldest uncle and cousins that are in London. So.
And you.
In me. But I was always around family, always around food. I went to some really good schools in Richmond. I always played sports, so I was a very active kid growing up. My favorite part about Richmond would be the summers when school was out. I would always be in like a summer school program or like a STEM program or hanging out with family. We would always go to the beach, get on the boat, cookout, picnics. We go to the river and hang out. So I really grew up out outdoors a lot. Sometimes in the summers, I would go down to the country and hang out there with cousins and family members, cooking. I would go to camp. So I was a very active kid. You know, I really appreciate being around my family as much, just having that connection.
Are you able to get back much?
Nowadays, not so much. I always go home for the holidays, so I'm always there for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I'll go at least 2 to 3 times throughout the spring and the summer.
That's not too bad for a working chef.
It's not, but my family comes here a lot. My mom's here probably every other month.
They're not allergic to New York?
No. My mom spent a lot of time in New Jersey growing up, so
oh, great.
She's familiar.
You mentioned sports. I'm always curious to know with people who end up becoming chefs. Team sports or individual?
Both. What didn't I play? I've done track. I did basketball. My favorite sport is softball. I played softball from elementary school up through my adult life. So I did a lot of adult teams in D.C. that would raise money for different charities and things of that nature. Volleyball, softball, basketball, track. And just now I started playing tennis for myself. I'm not really that good at it, but I like to play.
Oh, well, people who listen to the show know that I'm a tennis junkie. I used to write for Tennis Magazine.
Oh, wow.
I hope you'll keep with it. It's a great sport. It's hard to play now. A lot of people took it up during COVID because it's socially distanced.
Yes.
Okay, you mentioned food growing up. You said you were always around food. What kind of food? What did you all eat? And was it mostly home-based or were you all, and that's a big family maybe to take to a restaurant, but how did that play out?
You know, it's really interesting that you asked that. I didn't grow up eating out. It's something that I do now because I can and I'm in this industry, but growing up, everything was cooked at home. We ate a lot of pork. And other things that I don't know if I should have been eating, like squirrel and deer and turtle and all types of things, because my family is very country. But we ate a lot of pork, a lot of chitlins, a lot of pig feet, pigtails, a lot of traditional soul food staples like mac and cheese, potato salad, deviled eggs. I'm having so many flashbacks right now. Pretty much all Southern staples, but I would say there were some things that were not too common to me, like the rabbit and the chitlins and the things of that nature. Also a lot of oysters. Virginia is known for oysters.
It's funny to hear you list all the different proteins, animals that you just did because of what you're doing now. Because I would imagine that had you not made this shift in your own life and in your, you know, your kind of professional lane that you're in, that's kind of an amazing background for someone becoming a chef, right? Because you'd be open to basically anything.
Yes.
It'd be tough to like put something in front of you that you wouldn't eat or that would be like daunting or...
Exactly.
Did you have like a favorite thing? You said you had a lot of memories flashing by. Is there like a favorite, or is that like asking someone to pick their favorite child?
I would say fried oysters. We do it every year still for Christmas. My family, again, we do a lot of parties, a lot of food, a lot of family events. So for the past 30 years at my mom's house, she always does a big Christmas brunch. The entire family comes, she does an amazing spread, and there's always fried oysters and chitlins. It's the only time of the year they're cooked in our household. So, you know, everyone's always looking forward to Christmas so that we can get the oysters and the chitlins.
And are people still comfortable cooking for you and in your presence now that you've gone pro?
A lot of my family, my aunts, and also my mother, they have adapted to my style of eating. So they'll make things without animal products, like the collard greens they'll make without the ham hocks or the turkey legs. My mom also doesn't eat meat anymore. She's not vegan, but I guess vegetarian, pescatarian. So it's not too hard to make things, or I'll just cook for myself or order Chinese food or something.
But I also mean they're not intimidated to cook for you now that there's like a pro coming home for Thanksgiving.
Honestly, I'm still the baby of the family. I don't even think they really
think about it.
They don't really think about
it. Oh, that's good. So you were not always bound for the kitchen.
No.
You went to Howard University.
Yes.
What did you think you were going to do when you started on that path?
When I started at Howard, I was still playing sports, and I knew that I wanted to have a career where it was sports related, and I also had an interest in medicine and just helping people. So I actually went to Howard for pre-physical therapy because I wanted to do sports medicine. That quickly changed after a few chemistry classes, a few science classes. They were really hard, really challenging. So I started to pick up an interest for the music industry. So that's what I kind of spent my time doing throughout my time in DC and in college. I would go to school for physical therapy, but I would do my internships through the music industry.
Did you think you wanted to be a recording artist and performer? Did you want to be a studio musician? Did you just think maybe you wanted to be in the realm of music, but you didn't know how? Like, what did you think you wanted to do in that world?
I had no interest in being an actual artist. I like to be behind the scenes, funny enough, because I really don't like attention despite the amount that I'm getting now. So I wanted to be a tour manager and pretty much be a production manager as well for concert venues, which I did for a little bit of time. But things started to shift in my personal life. So that's when I started to really look into food and health and wellness.
This is the shift that you made in terms of you as an eater initially? That's
yes.
What you're talking about? Okay, I want to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Can we talk about Howard University for a second?
Sure.
Howard, big smile. You liked it there?
I love Howard. I still do.
I mean, Howard, as a lot of people probably know, that's a historical Black university.
Yes.
Was it important to you to go to a college or university that fit into that category?
Yes. Howard was my number one choice from the time that I started applying to colleges for many reasons. I think my main thing was I knew I wanted to go away for college, but I didn't want to be too far. Being from Richmond and going to Howard, that commute was only an hour and a half, 2 hours. If God knows anything were to happen, you know, I just needed family close by. I also had an older cousin that went to Howard, so I was really inspired by her journey throughout her industry. I mean, Howard just has everything that I wanted from my major, from the social life. You know, you really have to go there to understand it, but you know, it's a really loving community. I love the network. I love the people that I met. I loved everything that I learned, and it really set me up for success. Even though I didn't continue with the pre-physical therapy, it just set me up for success, giving me the tools that I need to succeed in the real world.
I was a little, I know a little about how, I mean, I've always known about Howard University. None of them listen to this show, but when I mentioned to you, one of my kids just started college. Mm-hmm. I'll just say one of my kids' closest friends really wanted to go to Howard, mm-hmm. and didn't get in, is holding out. It's taking a year off and reapplying. But I didn't know until recently that the school is only about 70% Black students. Mm-hmm. It's only about 1 or 2% white, but there's Native Americans there and Asian. It's I think it would be surprising to people that it's not 100% Black, right? Because of how it's known and categorized. And but that said, can you just speak to, you know, when I talk to people who come into your profession, there's a phrase that comes up a lot. You know, people talk about not seeing people that look like me, mm-hmm. right? You hear that a lot about people who want to go into fine dining, you know? And not just Black, you hear this from people of, you know, Latin backgrounds, and I didn't even apply there. There was no one there who looked like me. That's a phrase you hear a lot. I know a lot of women who went to all-women colleges or all-girl schools growing up, mm-hmm. and, you know, just having guys taken out of the equation was very empowering to them. Mm-hmm. Can you just speak to the dynamic of going to a school like Howard? And I would imagine that was probably a unique environment in your life. Like the time you spent there, that was probably an aspect of life that was completely turned what you're probably used to on its head.
Yes. I would say I felt very comfortable. I felt very empowered. And it was just nice to see people that look like me doing everything. I mean, you have doctors that look like me, lawyers that look like me, people that turned out to be chefs or physical therapists. So I was very inspired. And it was just like an overwhelming feeling of inspiration at all times, every single day. And, you know, you don't really get that feeling anywhere else, depending on where you work or depending on your upbringing, but it was just nice to have 4 years and see it every single day and have like a constant reminder that whatever you want to do in life, you can do it. Here's an example within arm's reach. Mm-hmm. You can talk to these people. You can get inspiration for them. These are your mentors. These are your peers. And it really just kind of set the tone for me coming out of Howard and just doing what I'm doing now. But it was nice to have that inspiration very early on, fresh out of high school, where, you know, the schools are a bit diverse, depending on where you're coming from, your city's a bit more diverse, but to have it within arm's reach, it was just like a beautiful sight.
So talk to me about this pivot that happens to the way, I mean, you just described this very, I mean, I probably didn't seem it to you, but to my mind, adventurous way of eating as a kid, this mm-hmm. kind of openness to anything, right? Which I think is enviable. I think that's great. But you made a big not even a U-turn, you did a 180.
Yes.
How did that happen? How did that come about? And how immediate was the transition, or was it more gradual?
It was a very gradual transition. You know, thinking about it now, I didn't even realize I was kind of moving in this direction. I remember at 11, I stopped eating ham and pork. When I was a kid, I used to always love ham. I don't know why, like, it was just my favorite thing to eat. And
because it tastes great.
It does.
What does John Travolta say in Pulp Fiction? Pork chops taste good.
Well, I just loved ham so much. And I remember I was 11, and one Thanksgiving, I got really sick. You know, I ate some ham, and it just kept, I feel like every piece of ham I ever had came out. So I got really sick when I was 11, to the point where I stopped eating ham. The smell of it started to make me sick.
You developed like an aversion.
Yes. And for 10 years, I didn't eat or touch ham. And I was 22. I was working in a restaurant. I was working in a concert venue kitchen in D.C. And I figured, I wonder what would happen if I tried ham again. And I tried it, and I had the same reaction. So from that point forward, I started to kind of subtract things out of my diet. I took out red meat very early on in my early 20s. And then I believe I took out like chicken and turkey. And I got to the point where I was only eating fish, pescatarian. And I did that for about 3 years. And then I got tired of seafood. And I'm like, okay, what's next? And someone recommended it to me, like, hey, why don't you try going vegan? I mean, I'm eating chitlins and oysters and pig feet. I don't even know what that word means. So I started looking into it, and I pretty much challenged myself, like, okay, why not? Let me try something new. And, you know, I tried it for 30 days. 30 days turned into 90 days, and then it turned into 8 years. It was more so about learning discipline. At that time in my life, I think I was like 22 or 23, fresh out of college, working on the scene in DC, not really having any discipline. So it was really good to start with my diet and see how that kind of rippled out to other areas of my life.
Do you miss it at all? Do you miss the things that you don't eat anymore?
Not really. There's a lot of different options out there. There's a lot of different vegetables and foods that people don't even touch or think about. So I'm more so interested in the things that I haven't had that I can kind of create new, or things that I used to eat out of them.
You know, it's interesting to me, and I'll tell you where the question comes from. I interviewed Amanda Cohen once, and, you know, I was asking about how do you design a menu that will appeal, on the assumption you want as many people as possible to want to come to your restaurant.
Right.
How do you design a menu that appeals to you know, a universal audience potentially? Mm-hmm. And she said to me, to be honest, I think you have to eat meat a little bit so that you know what you're compensating for, right? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like growing up not eating vegan? Do you feel like not being vegan until you got, you know, to the neighborhood of 20? Mm-hmm. has served you well in what you do now in terms of having a restaurant that, you know, doesn't fall into these cliches of, you know, the, you know, health food restaurant or,
right.
you know, the places that are, you know, like years ago, we would have said like the sprout and avocado, you know, sandwich, right. On multi, like that kind of thing that has a little bit more kind of, you know, oomph to the food. Right. Mm-hmm. Did it serve you well?
I think so. I think there's a lot of things that I don't know about meat in terms of a chef in the culinary world. There's a lot of things that I've never had, I've never tried, and probably never will, unfortunately, and I don't know how to cook those things. But I think the real key and the real trick is flavor and texture. Like, that's simply it. It doesn't matter if you're cooking meat or if you're cooking vegan, if it tastes good and there's a nice texture on there, you've got it. And I think I really was able to kind of polish those skills in culinary school, learning about different vegetables, learning to cook actually plant-based foods, not the fake meats, not the soy alternatives and things of that nature. So really taking the time to do recipe development, experiment a bit more with vegetables and fruits, and learning different techniques has kind of paved the way for me in the food that I'm making.
So how did you go about pursuing it? When you decide you are interested in pursuing cooking,
yes,
how do you go about tiptoeing into those waters, right? What are the early steps, and how did you know when it was the right call?
I've been cooking for quite some time. I remember even before I was vegan, I was cooking. My aunt Tina would give me a rack of ribs when I was in college and be like, here, cook this. No directions, but just, you know, like figure it out, like experiment. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was living with a couple of roommates off campus, and I'm just like, hey, my aunt sent me some ribs. I'm going to try to cook them. Let's figure this out. And every time I would cook, they would just be amazed, blown out of the water. So I think that was the first time that I kind of got an idea like, oh, maybe I can cook. So I continued to cook, wasn't necessarily cooking vegan, but once I decided that I was going to take this path and really start cooking vegan, I started with pop-ups around DC. I did about 3. They all sold out. I'm so sad at how much I used to charge. I used to charge like $30. It wasn't about the money then. It was just like I wanted to see what the response was to my food. So
yeah.
I didn't really care. I'm just comparing to like what I do now versus back then. You know, after selling out 3 pop-ups, it was kind of a thing where, okay, well, I know how to cook, but I really want to learn the proper technique. So let's start applying to culinary school. And that's what really prompted me to relocate to New York.
When you mentioned the, like cooking the ribs, right, for your mm-hmm. friends in school, was that intuitive? Like, did you break out a cookbook or did you go online and pull a recipe, or did you just kind of do it semi-intuitively based on kind of what you had observed, you know, as a kid, but, you know, hadn't really done yourself yet?
I've never owned or looked at a cookbook until probably 2 years ago. I've never watched cooking shows. I'm not that type of chef. My thing is more so just getting your hands in there and experimenting. So I literally took the ribs. I know I usually see them with barbecue sauce and I know seasoning, so I seasoned them. I think I just put them in the oven and put some sauce on them. But, you know, I do get inspiration from what other people are doing, but I'm more so of a, let me try to figure this out first. If I need help or something, then maybe I'll look on the internet or maybe I'll pull out a cookbook now. But back then it was more so just trying to figure out where I fit in the kitchen.
Did you have a pretty high success rate? Like it sounds like you, if I'm understanding you right, you have, you know, there's this artist, Chuck Close, that a million years ago I saw this interview and immediately I was like, I know chefs like that. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how he paints, right? And mm-hmm. he does, I don't know what it's called, but it's like, you know, these little bursts of color. And then mm-hmm. from a distance, it's not pointillism, but like from a distance, it looks like okay. something. And he was interviewed and said, I know how the colors are going to land. Right. And I just thought, I know people who are like that with flavor, you know, does that make sense when I say that?
Yes.
It seems to me like that's a little bit what you're describing about yourself. Was your success rate when you would try things, was it pretty high? Like, did you get pretty close by just kind of winging it based on your intuition of how, you know, meat, sauce, heat et cetera, temperature, how that was all going to interact. You had a pretty good sense of just what how that would play out.
I think so, but as cliche as it sounds, I think it's really in my blood. Everyone in my family can cook. Everyone. And, you know, just being around food, even if you're not really paying attention, those smells, like those flavors, and just kind of being in the room, it sounds weird, but I feel like it kind of like you kind of get marinated into the cooking world unknowingly. So I feel like that was my childhood. Like, I feel like I've just always been around food, even if I didn't know how to cook it. The smell. So I know if the smell is right, if I'm cooking something, that's how my grandma's pies used to smell, or like, that's how my mom's deviled egg smell, or something like that. So I think it's like a sensory thing too.
So cooking school, where did you go?
I went to the Institute of Culinary Education in New York.
And at what point in its evolution, was it still on 23rd Street or had it already migrated downtown?
Downtown location.
Oh, it was? Yes. Okay, that's a spectacular location.
It is.
Yeah. For people who don't know, that school started off as Peter Kump's Cooking School a million years ago in an apartment, I think, on the Upper West Side. Then it had a perfectly nice facility on 23rd. It's now like the Starship Enterprise. Like, it is this crazy, ultra-modern, very well-appointed facility down Brookfield Place's down right off the Hudson River. Yep. That was a good experience for you?
Amazing. I had no real expectations going into the program, but I think any that I would have had, it exceeded all of that. Every day I was excited to learn. Every day I was excited to cook. I didn't go in there like, I know how to cook. I don't need any of this information. It was the exact opposite for me. Every day I was so excited to be in class. I don't think I would be the chef that I am today without that program.
Did you do an externship from there?
So I was supposed to do an externship, but I ended up opening a restaurant, so that was my externship.
Okay. I want to talk about cadence. I want to talk about what you do there. Before we do, can we define a term? Soul food.
Soul food.
This to me is a loaded term.
Yes.
And not just for non-Black eaters, right? I have, we've talked about it on the show. Eric Williams and I had, do you know Eric has a Virtue restaurant in Chicago? Mm-hmm. Eric and I had this talk. Mashima Bailey and I had this talk. Mm-hmm. It's also, it's not necessarily a term that every Black person comes to the same way.
Yes.
Can you just, when you use that word, mm-hmm. that phrase, what do you mean by that? How would you define soul food?
For me, it's a very complex term, but I think the simplest way that I can define it is cooking from the soul. It's cooking with your ancestors. It's cooking with intention. It's cooking with, you know, those techniques that those before us have cooked with, cooking with those flavors, just keeping them in mind. And it's really truly coming from the soul because it's embedded in us.
So it's a little bit of it's a little abstract for you. It's a little it's as much about a feeling as it is about the actual nuts and bolts of what you're doing and how you're doing it.
Yes, it's kind of when it's a funny like inside joke, but sometimes when people are cooking, when a lot of like Black chefs are cooking and we're like seasoning something, it's like season it until your ancestors tell you to stop. And it's a funny inside joke, but it's true. Because a lot of times I'm not perfect with writing recipes, so I'll just like kind of season until like I hear my grandmother in my ear like, okay, that's enough. So
I love that. That is one of my favorite things anyone's ever said to me in an interview. That is great. Okay, so you decide you're going to do plant-based soul food.
Yes.
That is, even in the broad definition you just gave of it, I imagine that's a fairly, that's a new thought. It makes perfect sense that it's so of the moment in so many ways. I can tell talking to you, that it's not something that was that manipulative, right? But it, you know, it seems like a real product of your young life so far. But it is so right for the times, right? It hits all these things that people are really interested in. What was the learning curve like for you? Like when you decide, had you already been cooking a little like that in your own life because of the personal change you had made? Did you have to kind of, you know, have like a research and development period where you were just like trying stuff out with the idea that this is what's going to go on the menu in a restaurant? How did you get to the point where you were ready to unveil a menu, you know, to a paying public?
I can't say that I would cook soul food every single day in my vegan chef life. That's something that it's more so for me. It's a lot of times like for special occasions, or when I have like friends over or like Sunday cooking or things of that nature. And mainly because it's really hard to do a small portion of soul food. So, you know, if I'm doing soul food, I'm always having people over. I would say that some of the items that I have on the menu for Cadence, like the buffalo oyster chicken sandwich, that's something that I would make at home any day of the week. Or my mom's salmon cakes, which I turn into this thing I call palm cakes with heart of palms and chickpeas. That's also something I would make at home. But I had a long time to develop the menu there. I did about 8 months of recipe development. I think every week I would do 6 new different recipes, try them out, polish them up, tweak them, figure out my plating, try out different flours, cooking in different oils, switching out my sugars, just to really figure out how I could make the best menu possible. And I think it shows. I think it's well received. I think you can tell the amount of time and recipe development and love that was put into this menu. And, you know, I'm really grateful that it's being so well received by everyone.
Did you have, you know, like friend tasters who would give you feedback as you were developing or, oh, really? I thought you were going to tell me. Shows you what I know. I thought you were going to say, tell me that it was just all your own sort of, you know, personal divining rod that was leading the way. You had people giving you feedback?
I had 2 very happy roommates that would try my food every single time I would kind of like make a new recipe. And I was also still a full-time student in culinary school. So, you know, I'm full-time in culinary school. I'm doing menu development for the restaurant. So I had a lot of food and cooking going on at that time. So, you know, a lot of times if I had an idea, I would go to culinary school, learn a different technique the next day and apply that to the food that I was already creating. So I think that was really helpful as well. But there were times where I would actually take some of my recipes to my chef instructors at school as well and have them try it or get their opinions on things and get that feedback as well. So I had a lot of people trying my food at the time.
Were they supportive?
Very supportive. Very supportive. Very happy. Just kind of over the moon. The program, it makes me smile the way Howard makes me smile just to have these 2 schools and like these 2 group of different professionals kind of helping me outline my life, but very supportive.
So I just have to ask about what's your management style like as a chef? And I'll tell you why I ask. You, if you don't mind my saying, I just met you. I don't want to overstep. You'll know what I mean, though. People who work in kitchens, they just develop a certain, I don't know what you want to call it, almost like a swagger, you know? They have like, you can tell cooks sometimes on the street, you know, at a party, the way they come in, the way they carry themselves. I kind of mean it as a compliment. Mm-hmm. You don't seem to have that. You know, there's an attitude to that that you just seem unburdened by, you know, you seem very humble. Does this make sense what I'm saying?
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
Now, when you get to a leadership position in a kitchen, which you are, what is it like? Do you hire people that you don't need to discipline or correct a super amount of time? Do you try to bring in people that plug in well, I guess, to this aspect of your personality? Does that make sense?
Yes. I actually get that a lot. It's a couple of different things, but mostly it's about Southern hospitality. I treat people and I carry myself as if my mom is always watching me. So I'm very polite. I have manners. I know how to talk to people. I'm not a rude person. And I like to carry that into my workspaces and my kitchens as well. I want people to feel comfortable. I want to be approachable. I want people to know that, you know, just because I have this title, it doesn't mean that you can't do the same thing as me or that I can't do the same thing as you. So I'm a chef that will wash dishes. You know, I'll sweep and mop the floors. Like, I don't mind that. I don't mind doing that. I don't have a big chip on my shoulder. And I do understand that I haven't gotten to this position alone. It's because of all of the people that have helped me. So I think having that mindset and having that attitude is really going to help progress my career and also make me a nice, fun, approachable chef. But, you know, there's a lot of different stereotypes about kitchens. You know, you have the angry chefs, the chefs that are always yelling or throwing the plates and things of that nature. That's just not me. I like to carry myself the same way inside the kitchen and outside the kitchen. So, you know, a lot of my team members, they call me Mama Greens or Miss Greens. I'm always in the kitchen laughing because I want like a very nice, fun, relaxed work environment because it can get crazy. So the more that I can help kind of bring that down a little bit, I think the better my team members can perform.
Tell me if I'm naive. I would like to think that in the year 2022, the style of management and leadership you're describing is not that hard to achieve.
Yeah.
As opposed to what it might have been like to staff a kitchen with the mindset you have like 15, 20 years ago? Am I right or am I being a little naive?
I would hope that other chefs are carrying a similar mindset or model for their kitchens, but you know, it's hard to tell. So I know for me, I'm a leader, so I try to like lead by example. So if it's something that other chefs aren't doing or other restaurateurs or managers, you know, hopefully this message gets to them and they can start. But, you know, it's really not that hard to be nice. It's just not. You know, I think it's also about being organized, being understanding and, you know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes. Like, we've all started somewhere. Like, no one woke up and became an executive chef. There's steps, there's levels. So to feel like you can't relate to your dishwasher or your line cook, it's their first day fresh out of culinary school, you have to be understanding. And, you know, there's a pandemic, like something happened to everyone. So I think that if that doesn't help you become a better chef and like a more understanding chef, I don't know what else could.
I want to know if there's any dishes that you particularly have a particular meaning to you or you feel kind of sum you up on the plate, as I like to say. The thing I have to ask you, and I'm sure I'm not the first one, the fried lasagna.
Yes.
That, I mean, you just hear that, and first of all, you're like, well, it makes so much sense to me anyway. Mm-hmm. But where does that come from?
Majority of the menu, I'd say probably 85% comes from things I grew up eating. It's all my mom's cooking. It's all my family's cooking, family recipes. I am just adding my own culinary twists, things I picked up in culinary school, things that inspire me when I travel or things that inspire me when I go out to eat. So, but the base of it is definitely home recipes. The lasagna, I grew up eating lasagna all the time. My mom would make it for me and my older brother. It's one of those things where, you know, if she didn't feel like cooking something fresh every single night, there'd be lasagna available. And everyone knows lasagna tastes better on the second day or the third day. So, you know, taking that memory and taking those flavors and that concept and trying to make it more Southern, trying to make it easier to plate, trying to...
You mean in that it doesn't like slide apart?
Yes.
Or right, right.
I tried to make regular lasagna, but I didn't really understand the trick to how to properly plate it. So I figured frying it into these two giant like egg rolls would be a little bit easier. But taking all of those memories and creating something that is innovative and a little bit more futuristic, I guess, was the goal with that dish. And I think it's kind of like blowing everyone's mind.
Is that the most popular dish?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so popularity aside, for you personally, yes. Is there a dish or dishes that you feel like, just for you personally, that you feel like, as I like to say, that really sum you up on the plate, that are really reflective, whether it's of your childhood, whether it's reflective of your personality, just something that you really feel like, if I was going to come in and say, I want to pick one dish or two dishes that if I eat it, I'm going to get you.
Hard to say. I feel like I treat everything on the menu like my child. I have a very close connection with all of them. I think I have three, if that's okay.
By the way, if you don't want to do any, that's okay too. I feel bad now.
No, it's fine. I would say definitely the lasagna, because that is the most, that dish took the most time to create. I probably made the lasagna 50 different times, 50 different ways, and I really put my all into it. You know, from trying different flours to bread the lasagna, trying different brands of vegan milks, frying it in different types of oil, doing different like pine nut ricottas. There's so much that went into that dish, and you know, to see it being praised by everyone is just like, wow, like I really put the time into this dish, and this is the effect of that. So I would definitely say the lasagna, but also my palm cake, which is like a vegan crab cake. You know, I grew up eating salmon cakes for breakfast. So that is something that is very close to me. It's a childhood memory. And to make it vegan so that everyone else can try it and try what I grew up eating, but a vegan version, is really special to me. And lastly, I would say the buffalo oyster mushroom sandwich. It's fun, it's exciting, it's meaty, it's spicy, but there's also like avocado and the vegan ranch to kind of cool it down. So I think you're getting the best of both worlds in terms of a flavor palette there.
Okay, let's talk about Jay Vineyards and Shifting the Lens is the name of the, it's a trio of, what do we call these, residencies?
Yes.
You are the third. Yes. It's coming up soon. Tell us what you can about the program. Tell us how you found your way into it, and tell us what you're going to be doing there.
I am really excited to be participating with Jay Vineyards this year for the Shifting the Lens residency. I will be cooking, I'm not sure how many courses, but I will be cooking quite a bit of food for this residency for 2 weeks, the last week of September and the first weekend of October. I was actually approached by Chef Priti. They asked me about this program probably late last winter. And this was just like a general conversation asking me about, you know, interests, about doing a potential residency in with Jay Vineyards. And that conversation kind of led to a number of other conversations. I told Priti that I was interested, and fast forward, we are here today. But I'm really honored and humbled to even be included with this lineup of chefs. You know, I've been learning about both Chef Priti and both Chef Jenny throughout this process, and to see the work that they've done and to look at myself as one of the newer chefs on the scene, it's very flattering and it's very touching to even be included in this lineup. So I'm really putting a lot of work into it, putting a lot of thought into it, and ready to kind of like put out this menu that I've never done before, and also just to be given an opportunity to show my creative side outside of the restaurant. I think a lot of times when you're cooking in a restaurant, it, you know, you're cooking the same thing, so the creativity kind of is stagnant, but this is a great opportunity for me and all of the chefs included to do something outside of the norm.
And I will have mentioned this in the intro to the show, but we will link in the show notes for this episode to where people can get tickets. Jay Vineyards is in Healdsburg, California. And if you're anywhere in that area, yeah, it's something I would encourage people to check out. I should also say Priti is how we found ourselves here today. They sent me a release about the program. And I said, well, you've been on my show too. It's like more than anybody. I can't have you back on. I said, for what it's worth, I said, but you know, Shinari's been on my radar. We haven't connected. Maybe this is the right time. So that's how this came to be. And I'm glad it did. You got your hands full right now. You got a busy restaurant. You got this thing you're doing out west. Are you thinking about other projects? Are you thinking about what else might be in your professional life in the future? Or are you kind of have your plate full and you're good for now?
I am constantly doing something somewhere. This summer, you know, I was part of the James Beard Taste 20 Chefs. So I've been traveling around to different cities doing pop-ups. On top of that, I've been doing a lot of residencies in other places, including one in Costa Rica, one in LA. We have Jay Vineyards coming up, of course. So I keep myself pretty busy. Again, I like to stay busy. I like to stay motivated and inspired.
It was great to meet you. Thank you for coming on the pod. Thanks for coming in on a day off. And all the best out west with the Dinners with Jay Vineyards.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Shinari Freeman for joining us. Again, if you would like to check out Shinari's residency at Jay Vineyards Winery, visit the episode page for today's show at andrewtalkstochefs.com and click through to the link featured in the show description. Our thanks, as always, to Sam Pellegrino for their ongoing support of Andrew Talks to Chefs. And thanks to Bento Box and Clover for their support. From websites and marketing tools to point of sale, payments, and ordering, Bento Box and Clover together offer all the unified technology you need for restaurant success. Learn more and book a demo today at getbento.com/better. Andrew Talks to Chefs is produced by Table 12 Productions. The show is written, booked, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Andrew Friedman. If you would like to support us, we ask that you do that by telling a friend, posting about the show on social media, and or rating or especially reviewing us at Apple Podcasts, which really does help new listeners find the pod. Our thanks as always to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre on iTunes. Please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is at Chef Podcast. And thank you for listening. We will be back soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.